This is Trust Me, I'm Certified, brought to you by GX Certifications, a podcast exploring how to conquer imposter syndrome. Welcome back to Trust Me, I'm Certified. I'm your host, Jason Nicola, and I'm excited to bring you this week's episode with Chris Sanders. Chris is a busy guy, to say the least. He's the founder at both Applied Network Defense and the Rural Technology Fund, an accomplished trainer, a GX security expert, and is currently pursuing a doctorate in education. In his own words, though, Chris should not be where he is or have been able to build the career he has. From a lack of technical opportunities in his native Western Kentucky to having to forge his own path after tragedy struck his family at an early age, Chris's story is a powerful one filled with the kind of grit and determination you'd expect from someone who has built such an impressive career and skill set from scratch. I learned a ton here and was really inspired by some of the things Chris shared, so please enjoy this conversation with Chris Sanders. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah. So your passion for security and tech, as well as education, it's something that really comes out in pretty much everything that you do. We'll dig more into that in just a little bit, but where would you say that's rooted in? Like, when you look back at your past, are there things that you can look at and see, well, I was kind of always destined to be a security professional or always destined to really focus on how people learn? Are there things there?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I think I would start by saying I'm not really passionate about security. And that may be, you know, for the folks listening, that's a weird way to start a podcast about security. I'm really not. And it took me actually a long time to figure that out. And I went through several jobs and I was really digging in on the security stuff. And eventually I kind of realized like security was a mechanism that allowed me to kind of do things that I was passionate about, helping people. Right. I work with the Rural Tech Fund and trying to help people out of poverty and things like that. It took me a long time to get there. But with that in mind, I mean, and not to start off too dark, but I had a little bit of an interesting upbringing. I lost my mom and my sister when I was in high school, and my dad kind of ran out on us. So From about 15 on, I raised myself. And So I've always been pretty motivated, kind of, and I think it comes from that. I've always had a bit of a chip on my shoulder because I basically had to get myself up and get myself to school. I had to do my own schoolwork. I had to figure out groceries and transportation. I had to figure out what was next for me. What did college and what did a career look like? I was kind of forced into that. Right. So that sort of thing just always made me very motivated. And kind of ever since then, my life has been this series of figuring out how to direct that motivation and kind of identifying some of the sources of it.
So when you were a kid, even in high school, did you place as much emphasis on education as you did now? I mean, granted, as an adult, you have the benefit of some maturity, but has education always been a primary focus?
It has for the most part. One of the things, you know, and this is, I owe this to my mom, you know, she got her first computer because she was the secretary of 4-H, which was really big in West Kentucky when I grew up. She was our 4-H secretary, and she wasn't very good at how to use it. And so I was naturally drawn to it. And so I would have to teach her things. Right. I would take these really complex topics and break them down very simply for her. And I didn't know it at the time, but she was kind of de facto teaching me how to teach people.
Yeah.
And I've taken that throughout my whole career. You know, I wrote a book called Practical Packet Analysis, where I take something that's a very complex subject and try to break it down very simply for people at an introductory level. And all that came from my mom. And it, again, it took me a long time to realize that. Even, you know, I was probably on the second edition of that book even before I realized, wow, this is actually where I got a lot of that from.
Right. I don't think I've ever heard something in someone's past that so neatly lined up with what they would end up doing that. Yeah, I taught my mom, and I had to take complex topics and break them down to be very simple. And, you know, just in the back of my mind, it's like, you know, that's teaching. That is, especially in security, where you get people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And, you know, oftentimes you have to teach to more than one person with more than one learning style at a time. It's so cool to see that you've been able to identify that and, you know, hopefully carry a little bit of that forward with you so that every time you teach now, you get to think about that history and background that you have with your mom.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things when it was happening at the time when I was 13 and teaching her about this stuff, I hated it and I would get so frustrated.
Right.
But I mean, I think if, you know, she could see what I was doing now, she would kind of laugh and you know, certainly gloat and take some credit, and I don't blame her. But really, that's kind of been a through line for all of my career. I mean, I teach for a living all full time basically now.
Right.
But even when I was working, you know, at Mandiant or with the Department of Defense or at Guardians, I always had some type of educational role, and I right. always found a way to be teaching. And one of my mantras has always been that any room with more than one person in it can be a classroom.
And so yeah.
I'm trying to live That's that as best I can.
That's really cool to hear. So as far as the technical side, so you were younger and you had to teach your mom how to use this computer. How did you learn how to use it? Did you just start digging in and get interested, or did you have more of a background? And was that kind of just what you did as a kid and dug in and learned things?
You know, I think the first thing that drew me to the computer, probably what drew a lot of us to it, was just games. I realized you could use the computer to play games. And this computer we had was like this beat up old 386 that didn't work really well. So
right.
when I wanted to play games and it didn't work, I had to figure out how to fix it, because we certainly couldn't afford to pay anybody to fix
yeah.
it. So that's what I did. And I kept doing that over and over again. And eventually, you know, computers at school would break. And mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh, I know how to fix this. And I would do it. And kind of it snowballed. And here I am.
Yeah, it's funny. I recently bought a Sega Genesis because we've all been, you know, looking for things to do the last 3 months or so yeah. to fill our time. And I picked it up and I flipped it over and I realized that there's this little like access port for expansion if you just slide off this little door. And it reminded me of being honestly like 4 or 5 years old and doing that when I was a kid and just wondering like, what does that do? And then looking at all the ports and, you know, like even opening up wires and looking inside of it. And I never would have remembered that if I didn't go and buy this thing. So one thing I'm always really interested in learning is, what are those tiny threads that maybe they don't stand out over time, but when you look back and you can kind of reconstruct or, you know, kind of force a path in there. Like, yeah, it was always obvious that Chris was going to end up being a technologist that taught other people, even if it didn't seem very apparent from the beginning. And I have yeah. a lot of those same things in my own past as well. But Absolutely. would you say that, you know, back then looking forward, that you felt like you were going to be a technologist and that education was going to be something that you pursued professionally? Or how did you view your prospects when you were younger?
You know, particularly in high school, when I was starting to fix computers for other people and they were offering to pay me for it, that's when I really started to kind of gravitate towards, this could actually be my job.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing, because in West Kentucky, there weren't really a lot of other options available. So once I figured that out, like I couldn't see anything else. The education side of it, I really didn't grasp until much later, even until after I'd written some books. Like I really, that seemed too far out of my realm of capability. For one reason, I was deathly afraid of public speaking. Even through college, if you were to go to my college professor, public speaking professor right now, and say Chris like goes out to these conferences and does all these things and speaks to thousands of people, she wouldn't believe you. She'd think you were lying.
Right.
But eventually that kind of just came to me, and I realized I wanted to do it, and I practiced at it and did more of it and got decently good at it, I think. And so I had to, you know, once I realized I had the propensity to build the content and I could relay those concepts, I had to work past some of my own internal barriers,
right.
like my fear of public speaking and things like that.
So let's dig into that for a second. Other than just, you know, time and reps, were there things that helped you get over the hump with public speaking, specific resources or groups or anything like that?
No real specific resources or group. Honestly, and this is not an exciting answer, but yeah, it was really just reps and kind of thoughtful, deliberate practice
right.
at it. You know, I put in, when I first started doing public speaking, it was to teach packet analysis classes mm-hmm. to these groups. And it was a lot of pressure because they were paying me to come in and teach them this stuff. And I wanted to earn that money. Like I didn't want to leave there. And like, I was definitely afraid they were going to ask for a refund.
Right.
Yeah. and I was poor. And we talk about motivation. Like one of my main motivators when I was that young was I was poor. I was on my own. I was paying for college and like I was living in poverty. I was sleeping in my car and a couple times during college when they kicked us out of the dorm for like spring break and stuff like that. Like
right.
I needed to make money. So I knew this was a way to do that. And I wanted to do a good job of it. And I knew that if I did this well, it would lead to other potential career type things. So it was extrinsically motivated in many ways in that regard, but it was really just, I would go in and I would prepare insanely. I focused on relentless competence. I knew if nothing else, I could sit up there and ramble about TCP/IP for 6 hours and hopefully people would learn some things.
Right.
And then, the cool thing about that type of learning is it's really never ended for me. Every time I do a presentation, I don't go back and sit and watch them all, but I'm very conscious of what I'm working on when I go into it and how I did with that thing when I'm done.
Right.
And I seek the right type of feedback from people who I trust, which really means a lot.
Right. So you mentioned, wanting to be really credible and capable and relentlessly pursuing a mastery and expertise of your subject matter. One of the things that I identify with is, feeling like you don't belong or you aren't good enough for some of the things that you've lucked into an opportunity to do, and trying to compensate for that by doing way, way, way more work behind the scenes and at night and between things when no one is looking to try to get to that magical bar where, okay, I've mastered this stuff enough that, these feelings can't possibly be real. Was there some of that for you? Were you trying to overcome maybe a feeling that you didn't belong doing what you were doing? Or is it more, I have to succeed and this is how I'm going to do it?
Oh yeah, there certainly was some of that and still is some of that. I mentioned I have a chip on my shoulder. Like I'm a kid from West Kentucky, and
yeah,
it's a place, if you want to get there, you fly to Nashville and drive 3 hours. Like it's not on anyone's map. You really have to want to get there to get there. And I have this thick accent, and most people, but people hear me talk and they don't know me. They think, a lot of people hear a Southern accent, think the person's stupid, right? Like there's documented scientific evidence that people think those things. And I always had that chip on my shoulder. I remember working for the Army at one point, and a colonel walked up to me and said, "Oh, you're from Kentucky. Well, there's no intellectual capital in Kentucky." And, you deal with things like that. So just based upon where I'm from and what I sound like, that's certainly part of that. And also, I came from very little. Like my dad was a truck driver. My mom was a sewing machine operator. We lived in poverty. There's no reason I should really be here if you look at my past, but I am. So that chip on my shoulder has always been one of those things that made me feel like I didn't belong.
Right.
And I also say, like, kind of going back to an earlier part of the conversation, for a lot of time, I thought I was passionate about security. I really tried to be the best at certain things. And one of the things you realize as you gain more expertise is you're never going to be the best at really anything. There's always going to be someone who knows something more. And knowing what you don't know is a pretty crucial thing there. But once I realized that a lot of my passions lied outside security, and security was just a vehicle or a vessel to help me achieve those things, it made me be more okay with it. It made me, certainly I understood that I don't always fit in certain facets of security. But I was a lot more okay with it once I figured that out. So it's kind of an acceptance of, like, this is who I am and I'm okay with that part of it.
Right. It's kind of like finding your niche and finding where you can provide the most value and then, feeling most comfortable with that. I think that's a really great message.
Yeah. And that's really, that shift in me, like figuring out what I actually care about, has really only happened, I would say it started maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I really started to conceptualize it like 3 or 4 years ago. So this is not like a far in the past thing for me. I think might surprise some people since I've been writing and teaching for so long.
Right. So you mentioned not a lot of opportunities in Western Kentucky and growing up kind of poor and wanting to find something to have better opportunities for yourself. I was going to ask the question, did some of those experiences feed why you eventually started the Rural Tech Fund? But I'm pretty sure that the answer is probably yes.
yeah, absolutely. I have this distinct memory of sitting in our high school honors day, and everybody got scholarships for all these different things going to college. And there wasn't really anything for kids interested in computers. And why would there be? I was the only one that anyone knew about who had any interest in that in my county. And I think that's what happens with a lot of these rural counties, particularly back then, is every school has like one kid who's really into this. And they eventually, get some more education, move on and go elsewhere. And I thought, well, heck, if every county has one kid like me that's just kind of getting, ignored and there's not a lot of opportunity for them, that's a lot of people.
Right.
And of course, now I think that's not just one. I think these counties, maybe even the most rural of them, have 5 or 6 kids like this in some cases. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be cool to be able to do something for them. I didn't really know what it would be when I started it fully. I just knew I was going to offer a scholarship, once a year. And I guess, boy, has it grown.
Right. So you say that there are few more kids now in these rural places now that might be interested in technology. What do you think is contributing to that? Is it just more tech making its way into K-12, internet and social media? And how can we help?
I certainly just the general proliferation of technology is that. Not all, but most kids now have computers in their home. Even the most rural schools are now able to do things like one-to-one computer-to-student ratios, thanks to different forms of federal funding and lowering the cost of equipment. So that's not everywhere, but it is a lot more places and will continue to be so. So, you know, kids now see computers, they understand their role in life and civilization, particularly, you know, with the pandemic, right? Like we depend on them so much more than ever. And people see this, and just the general exposure of the internet, social media, people know that those careers exist. When I was a kid growing up, not to date myself too much, but like I didn't know what careers existed out in the world other than what I saw on TV, which could be entirely fiction depending on what I was looking at, or what I saw in my own community, which was, well, virtually nothing, like a little tiny bit of manufacturing, a lot of farming, and then just like service jobs. So now kids have, they're able to see more of what is out there. And I think that's a useful thing. So part of what the Rural Tech Fund's job is and what I try to do is say, well, not only do I want you to see what's out there, I want you to see that it's interesting. It can, you know, pull you and your community out of poverty. And also, hey, you can probably do this. You don't have to be a genius to do this.
Right. So when you were coming up, would you say that there was someone that provided a model for you that had a career in technology, or an older person that was interested in technology, or just because of the timing, was it really just you until you, you know, got to college or started working in the industry?
You know, I had a couple of people that I kind of looked to, some more than others. And really, you know, I mentioned games got me into computers first. And one of the other people that got in, this is kind of a weird story, but it kind of begins with my cousin, Billy, building a meth lab. and he built, he was like, he was a pioneer. He built this meth lab. He went to jail because that's what happens when you practice redneck chemistry. And he did that, and he learned about computers. He took a computer class when he was in prison. Came back, and he's like, and he was showing me, like, he showed me some stuff on the computer, like the games and things like that. And he started, like, he was also at that point, like, taking money from people to fix their computers because he couldn't get work as an ex-con.
Right.
And so that was certainly one of my influences, fortunately in good ways and not some of the others.
Right.
And then beyond that, like, I didn't really have a lot of role models to look up to who worked in computing at that point. I just fortunately had a lot of teachers in my life who saw that I had an interest in this and I was capable of it. And they did their best to push me in the directions they know would be most beneficial to me, like going to college, for instance, which was probably one of the better decisions I ever made in life.
Well, I didn't know where you were going with that, Chris, but it ended up really well. And I'm glad Billy turned it around.
Yeah, me too.
So you initially studied telecom systems in college. How would you say that experience in higher ed translated to your ability to get a job?
It didn't. that program at my college at Murray State was brand new. At that point I was working, I'd been hired from the school district I graduated from to basically be their network administrator. They realized they could hire me for cheaper than they were paying for these consultants to come in and do the work. And it would also be a good thing because it basically allowed me to pay for college. So, that was going on. And at this point, I had as much or more experience than a lot of my professors. I remember at one point I had to take a class called packet analysis. And this was like a year after my book had come out. The professor like saw that I'd written this book and said, hey, this is silly that you have to take this class. If you'll just help me build some labs for it, I'll give you full credit. So some cool things like that happened. But for the most part, I didn't really learn a lot in college from my technical classes. Now, with that said, I actually learned a lot from other classes. I was thoughtful enough, I guess, or maybe I just looked into it where I took some classes a little outside of the realm of what I was doing. Like I took a couple of psychology classes, which is certainly paying dividends now. I really learned a lot from like World Civ. I had a World Civ professor who was brilliant. And that my World Civ class, which is one of the most dreaded classes in all of college, I think for most people, it really taught me how to learn and taught me how to like be aware of my own learning and think about that, this concept of metacognition and thinking about thinking. And that was absolutely critical and probably formed a big base for a lot of the work I'm doing now. So that necessarily didn't translate into me getting into the workforce at the time, but it's been a super valuable thing later on as I've really embraced some of it.
I love those things where even if it's not immediately applicable, you learn something and then, you know, a few years later, something clicks and you figure out a way to leverage that prior knowledge that you hadn't seen before. And then it's like, oh, I took this random class or did this random thing or had this random conversation. And I had no idea how that would pay forward years down the line. And now I'm, you know, reaping the benefits of something that almost happened by chance.
Oh yeah. And you don't realize sometimes the role people will have in your lives until much later. And you know, I think of this World Civ professor, his name was Tafiq Rashid, and he's still there. He's still teaching. And I was back at Murray State a couple of years ago to receive a Distinguished Alumni Award. And so I just went and found him. I walked up to his office and was like, hey, I don't think you remember me. And of course he didn't, but like, you had a tremendous impact on my career. And I don't think I would be anywhere at all where I am without you. And like, he was brought to tears. He was like, you know, he's been teaching at this point, like 30 years. And he said, like, I was only the second student to ever come back to him after taking his class and like say something like this to him, which was, we all had a good cry and it was great. But I don't know. It just made me really think about, like, you just don't realize the impact some people have on you. It's never too late, unless it is too late to kind of go back and let people know about that, which is useful.
You've taught thousands of people to this point. Have you had students come back and tell you something similar?
I have. And it's awesome. You know, I'm fortunate. I've had many jobs in this field that were very thankless. The one I'm doing now is not at all. I have students, I get emails weekly from students here. Some of them maybe have just taken a class and like, oh, wow, I use this thing. Or, you know, they'll send me a DM on Twitter and they're like, wow. Or they run into me at a security conference and they tell me about the impact it's had on their life. And I love hearing about that. I love hearing about when people take my classes and they leverage that and that gets them a job or it gets them a raise. And like, now they're able to better provide for their families. And, you know, there was a point in my life where I was really consumed with wanting to be the best. You know, I want to be the most passionate about this. I want to care the most about this. I want to make this big name and do all those things. But at this point, you know, and really in the past like 7-8 years, I've really been drawn to this idea of like, let's use what I have to enable that sort of thing for other people. Right. And that so far has been a very rewarding experience for me. And I think I've been fairly successful at it.
I love it. So when did security come into the picture? And do you think there was a benefit to you starting outside of a security focus?
So security really came into the picture when I was working for the school district that I graduated from. I was a network administrator. I was the only one for this entire district. So security fell under me as well. And I remember at the time, like, I installed like version 0.01 beta of Snort, the IDS on the school network. And as I tell people, I saw a lot of things that I couldn't unsee very quickly. As is the nature of things when you install an IDS on a network that's never had that before. Mm-hmm. But it just immediately hooked me, the investigative side of things and like finding bad guys and getting them out of the network. And like, that just immediately pulled me in. So, that got me into security. And, you know, I think there's a lot of paths into security. And I think that's in some ways the beauty of the industry, in some ways kind of a limitation of it. Cause, well, that's a little beyond our scope, but anyways, I do think there was valuable for me because obviously, you know, if, you know, I'm an investigator, I'm concerned about stimulus and response systems, and having set up and configured and troubleshot a lot of those systems, I understand that a lot better. Doing help desk type work, I better understand customer service. I better understand how people think. There's some diagnostic related thinking that comes with that, which is part of my research now that really flows well into investigative type work. So I certainly, mm-hmm. while that is not the only path into this field, it was certainly one that worked for me.
Sure. So there's a quote from a tweet that you had. It goes, so if you're looking to get into security from another technical area, it's not so much about pivoting your skill set, but leveraging it further. It's an evolution using what you've already acquired. Embracing that, but not being limited by it, is important. I think that's fantastic and absolutely sums up the same way that I feel about it. A follow-on question is, do you think that there are similar things for people who do not already work in technology, but work in other fields and are interested in getting into security? Are there things that generically you could look for in other fields that might hint at potential success in security?
Sure. That's a big question, but you know, I think, you know, a lot of what security boils down to is kind of investigative thinking. Right? It's this notion of we have some type of input, we ask questions about that input, we look at evidence to find answers, and we build timelines of things that have gone on in order to solve problems. When I describe it that abstractly, it could really apply to a lot of different fields. It mm-hmm. certainly applied to, you know, help desk type work. It applies to what people in medicine do, what nurses and what doctors do. It applies to the financial industry and how you apply things there. It applies to lots of sciences. Right. Investigative thinking is not something that is exclusive to what we do in this field. We do it every day, both in our professional lives and in our personal lives to some factors. So mm-hmm. becoming aware of that type of thinking, this notion of metacognitive awareness, being mm-hmm. aware of how you think about things, is absolutely crucial. And one of the things we know is certainly the highest performers in our field are incredibly metacognitively aware in some cases. But more importantly, the folks who are metacognitively aware assimilate experience much, much quicker. So right. if you're aware and you're able to consciously think about what you're doing, if you're able to deliberately practice things, not just practice them, not just get in reps, but get in those reps with the idea of getting feedback in mind from people you trust or from sources you trust, mm-hmm. working on one thing at a time, looking at different scenarios and acquiring a diversity of experience. Those things all lend themselves well to accumulating experience and assimilating it faster in the security field. A lot of what will make folks successful if they're not in security and getting into security has nothing to do with, you know, securing a web server or using
the technical specifics.
It has very little to do with that in most cases.
Yeah, I completely agree. You can teach someone who is willing and able and interested the, you know, how to code or, you know, how to configure an IDS or how to attack a web app, but do they have that investigative and curiosity that you mentioned? I think that's very well said.
And that's the key word right there, curiosity. It's that desire to know more. And I've written a lot about curiosity. I've spoken a lot about curiosity. That information is out there, so I won't repeat it all. But curiosity is inside all of us. A lot of times it's not necessarily about creating curiosity. It's preventing other things from smashing our curiosity. Because that's kind of what the world tries to do to us. In the midst of a global pandemic with tons of justified civil unrest, it's easy to let curiosity be stamped out, let alone all the other things we have going on in our lives. So actively defending your curiosity and doing things to kind of keep that going is one of the things that's going to separate you.
And I think that's such an important point as it relates to doing too much and burnout, because I find in my own personal life that as I get spread too thin and I get burned out, the first kind of flame that dies is my curiosity and willingness to just go explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's this notion in kind of psychology text called margin theory. And margin basically says we have these two components that we're dealing with. One is called power and one is load. Load are all the things that kind of deplete us. Things like the pandemic. It's things like, you know, I'm worried about money, or I'm worried about school, or I'm worried about my significant other, relationship problems. All those things are your load. Power is kind of the opposite. It's all the things that kind of push you forward. It's things like, you know, I like my job. It's things like I have a support system at home. I have a support system with my family. I'm wealthy, right? Like those things are your power. The difference between your power and your load is called your margin. People with lots of margin are generally going to be more curious because they have the cognitive capacity to be more curious. People with low or negative margin, they can't, their bucket's full. They can't really add anything in there. So it's right. A bit of an abstract concept, but these notions of power, load, and ultimately margin are crucial to really all things motivation. Motivation, massively complex thing. You take a psych course on adult learning, you'll spend half of it on motivation because that's so critical to how adults learn. But that margin part of it kind of underscores all of it.
Spoken like a true doctor of education student.
Yes, sir.
So you've done a ton of training in terms of your own learning and offering training for others. You're certified as a GSE and lots of other things. What role would you say that your opportunities to do formal training and certification have played in your ability to develop as a professional?
Good question. So I think it's changed a little bit. Earlier in my career, you know, the certifications were to some degree extrinsically motivated because I knew I needed them to get jobs.
Right.
But also, particularly after I got the first one, I think my first certification, I got the A+ certification when I was, something like 17. And it kind of proved to me that I could do it. Mm-hmm. So that caused later certifications to be a little more intrinsically motivated because I certainly learned some things while doing the A+ certification, particularly at the time and the type of work I was doing. But it proved to me that I can do it. And I think that's what happens with a lot of folks, particularly with their first certification. This stuff is daunting, right? It's very hard when you're just approaching it because you don't know what you don't know. It's all this abstract information. You don't have mental models built for processing it yet. So whether it's kind of a simpler certification like A+ or something really complex, like even like a GSE or like a CISSP to some degree, they have this ability to like make you think you could do things you couldn't do. They can, you know, I always believe that knowledge gives you superpowers. And when you're able to demonstrate your knowledge, that that kind of bolsters that. So
right.
you kind of seek like increasing challenges. And that's what I did. I got the A+ certification, then I got some Microsoft certifications, eventually some SANS certifications, the CSSP at some point, which, you know, gets knocked a lot, but it's a ton of information that you have to synthesize. And that's doing that successfully is something to be proud of.
Sure.
And then the GSE, which is an insanely difficult challenge for me at the time. And so I just kind of set up more and more of these things that kind of helped me prove to myself that I can do it. And they certainly had utility for getting jobs and proving expertise. But particularly when we're talking about things like dealing with burnout, proving to yourself that you're competent, certifications provide a mechanism to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one, it's similar to what you're saying, one thing that they've done for me is kind of pushed me out into the world and had me interact at these training courses with people that I might not have had the opportunity to interact with, instructors and students alike, and not just the learning and gaining of skills and then eventual credential that you get, but realizing when you have limited experience in the community that, hey, I can hang with these people. I don't, you know, fall all over myself when I communicate with them about social or technical topics, and I can be in the same environment as some of the best people in the world and hold my own. And I think, you know, if you pay attention to InfoSec Twitter or conferences, you start to think that that is all or most of security and technology, when in reality, most of it is people that, you know, are at home and go to work and then that's it. And they don't have maybe a lot of experience interacting with other people in the field from areas that they're not in. So I think that process of mixing and not measuring, because that sounds like a negative, but just getting that sense that, yeah, I belong here and I can stand up and, you know, back up what I'm saying. I think that is a very, very important part of feeling secure in yourself in your field.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the social media thing, and particularly when we talk about motivation and curiosity, for some folks, I think the notion that like the entirety of security is what you see on Twitter or something like that, whether people realize it or not, is a massively demotivating thing, because yes. just the nature of that type of communication and all these things. And you really got to be careful and curate that stuff. I've gone to pretty extreme efforts to like be very careful about who I'm following, because I just noticed this stuff affects me. And like, there are a lot of people who are really smart and have a lot of really useful things to say in our field, but like, it's also laced with all this negativity and,
right.
and it's, you know, the drama of who said what, when, and how, and this and that. And like, eventually at one point I realized there are enough smart people in this field with great ideas that I can just follow the ones who are also generally like realistic and positive
for
and
sure.
get what I need out of social media. It took me a while to get there, but I feel good about that now.
So you've also had some experience as a SANS mentor. You've worked at companies like InGuardians and Mandiant. What was that experience like? Because those are a very highly talented communities, I guess I would say from the outside, speaking about Mandiant. What was it like for you to begin to mix with those communities, and what kind of rub off or effect did that have on you in your own career?
You know, it was a little bit different in different places. I know within Guardians, I was very deliberately kind of going to work with a company that was very penetration testing, red team focused. Mm-hmm. And there was value in me coming because I was bringing some blue team expertise to do some of that type of work, but I also knew I was going to get exposure to ways of thinking that were new to me.
Right.
I always tell people it was kind of like the room springa for the Amish community, where, you know, when they turn 18, they can leave the Amish community for a while and decide if they want to go out into the broader world or come back. And that's what I did. This was my room springa to the red team. And I learned a lot of valuable information there. Obviously met a lot of great friends who I'm still in contact with today, but realized that that type of work was not really for me. Mm-hmm. But learned a tremendous amount. And I compare that with Mandiant, where Mandiant is kind of, particularly at that time, was one of the meccas of like blue team work. There's been a lot of shifting around and stuff like that, particularly with the Fire acquisition. But like at that time, you name like the big names in blue team work, or like most of them, or at least half of them, were at Mandiant. So that was cool. It was also very intimidating, because for the most part, anything I knew, there was someone there who probably knew more about it. So to some degree, a little bit of a humbling experience, which I was prepared for. That was good. But it also allowed me to like spread my wings and figure out where I wanted to focus. And it was really at Mandiant that I kind of started to find more purpose. And actually, it was realizing that the purpose was not at Mandiant. It's when I realized that, you know, the work I did was very disconnected from actually helping people. And this isn't a knock on Mandiant. It's just the nature of being a security vendor. I helped build this product, which, people use to secure their networks, which does good things. But there's a lot of steps between me and that happening.
Right.
And one of the things I really realized was I needed for me to be at my best and be my best self and do my best work, I needed to be able to draw straight lines between the tangible work I did and the people I helped. Mm-hmm. I couldn't really do that at Mandiant. I don't think I could do that really at any security vendor, or most security vendors, given the nature of that work. However, doing what I'm doing now, full-time teaching, full-time writing, researching, the people I help, I'm talking to them. Like, I'm tangibly talking to them every day. You know, we talked about they're coming back and telling me how thankful they are for that. That's been, you know, finding that Mandiant and that diversity of experience and expertise they have there allowed me to find that and realize that's what I wanted to be doing, which I'm, you know, very thankful for.
So education and security and technology are obviously major parts of your story. What gaps do you see in security education in our industry and, I guess, technical education in society overall?
Ooh, that's a big question. you know, that's a lot of my focus now. You know, I'm working on this doctorate, which is, it'll be a doctorate in education, but it's heavy focus in cognitive psychology. And obviously it's all centered on security. So that's one way of saying my professors love me because this is really weird for them. You know, a lot of the problems we have in information security are education problems. Most of the knowledge we have is very tacit. That means it's unwritten. People know how to do their jobs, but they don't know how to tell you how they do their jobs. And that's a big problem. It's an artifact in part because this field is so new. It's so young. And we forget that sometimes. Most of our best practices have still yet to be defined. We lack a lot of mental models we need to understand, process, and teach things. And we also, particularly in education, something I've been thinking about a lot lately is this notion of andragogy. And that's a word most people have never heard. Andragogy basically means teaching and educating adults. People have heard of pedagogy, and pedagogy often gets used as like a catch-all word for like, this is how you teach anybody, but pedagogy is actually specific to children. And most people don't realize how you teach children and how you teach adults, they're dramatically different things in a lot of ways. And it's cybersecurity, de facto, we're mostly teaching adults because, you know, you can learn a little bit of cybersecurity in high school, but there's some prerequisite knowledge. So that's really not happening until college age, kind of a formal level. And then after that, so mostly we're teaching adults, and adults have a lot of different things going on. Education is something that simply happens to children. They kind of experience it. For adults, it kind of defines who they are. Like, it's part of their identity because adults have agency. Adults can choose, I want to learn this or I want to learn that. They're self-directed learners. They have a high degree of self-directedness. So what people learn in their prior experience as adults, it defines their identity. And anytime something defines someone's identity, it changes the game and how you approach it, how you talk about it. Like, this is why with people you don't know very well, this is why you often don't have conversations about religion or politics, because those things define their identity.
Right.
People's education also has that same thing. If you don't believe me, like, just go have a conversation with someone and say, well, why did you learn that? That seems silly. And you're going to be in for a world of hurt on that. Mm. So you have to acknowledge those things when you're teaching adults. It's a challenging thing. You have to acknowledge adults' experiences. Because when you have an adult in a classroom setting and they have experience, if you reject that experience, you're not just rejecting the experience itself. You're rejecting that person.
Right.
And that turns people off. It turns off their motivation. It turns off their curiosity. Like, they are going to shut you out and you are not going to reach that person. I'm not one of the sorts of folks who believes that, like, as an instructor, it is my job to reach every person, because I don't believe I can. I think instruction is a relationship between a student and a teacher, and just like other types of relationships. If you put all the blame on one person, that's generally not usually the case, right? It's usually like a combination of that.
Right.
Sometimes learners and educators are not paired well together for different reasons. But that doesn't mean we can't strive as educators to, like, really focus on what's unique about adult learning. Let's acknowledge and pull out the existing experience people have, and let's work that into what we're doing. So this notion of andragogy, the principles that surround it, something that the industry really has mostly ignored, kind of on the whole.
Hmm. And I've read things that you've written on the topic, and, you know, as someone who does a lot of teaching, I feel and agree that the concept of practitioners first and kind of teacher second can be problematic. And I think if you want to be someone that is going to educate and try to reach as many people as you can, then you, I feel I own a responsibility to try to become the best educator that I can. So, you know, hearing you speak about things like that and reading things that you write on the topic and other things are, I think, an important part of starting to bridge some of that, because I don't even know that many people understand or recognize that there is a gap there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're mentioning, you know, I'd sent you, for the folks that know, by the time this podcast is released, I'll have published a new article about this andragogy topic and some thoughts there. And you mentioned the practitioner first, educator second model, which is something I write about in the article. And that's generally how most education occurs in our field, whether it's at SANS or other private training, even at some universities, the person is a practitioner first, and then they're an educator. Mm-hmm. And you know, if everything were gumdrops and rainbows, everyone would be educators and they would have the cybersecurity knowledge and that would all work. But that's not how it works. Practitioner first, educator second. That's how our industry is going to be for the foreseeable future. But we have to realize that education is not simply relaying rote concepts. It's not saying, this is a procedure, here's how you do it, steps 1 through 10. I've showed it to you, so now it's done.
Right.
That's not how education works. You have to approach these things in ways, again, that incorporate the experience of people, that acknowledge the agency that adults have, that acknowledge that people, you know, there's kind of a myth that people learn in different ways, like this whole notion of learning styles. There's really not any science to support that. Most people learn in the same ways, but how people learn is a little bit different than the notion of approaching information in different forms. So, for instance, you know, I can talk all day long about packet capture, and different people will understand what I'm talking about, and some will not. But some people will only understand that when I apply that to a real world situation that makes sense to them. Like, you have to connect to what they already know. You have to meet people where they are. And that gets harder for adults because they already know so much more, and their information is so much more nuanced, which means it's also so much more biased in some ways.
Right.
So you have to kind of work within that general construct.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of the importance of storytelling and narrative in teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. That's connecting with people, and it's kind of a broad concept, this notion of connecting with students, but meeting them where they are and connecting their existing knowledge to the knowledge you're trying to relay, and then to future knowledge. How can they use that in the future, and what is the application of that knowledge? It's not just, are they going to walk away with something from this class? Is it, are they going to be able to apply that to make the world a better place?
Right.
Well, that's kind of what we're all in it for.
I think that's a great point to end on. Chris, thank you so much. This was a fantastic conversation.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
That was Chris Sanders. Thanks so much to him for sharing his story with us. If you want to learn more about the World Tech Fund and how you can help, visit worldtechfund.org. Really appreciate all of you joining us again for another episode of Trust Me, I'm Certified. We'll be back in 2 weeks, so don't forget to sign up at gac.org/podcasts and wherever you choose to listen for alerts about new episodes and guests. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.